You are not the master of your own house. There are spirits that dwell in you, within you, meaning you have a will and you can exercise a certain amount of conscious control over your being, but there are all sorts of things that occur within you that seem to be beyond your capacity to control. Your dreams, for example, that's a really good example, or your impulses, for example, you might think of those as so foreign from you that they're not even, you don't even want them to be part of you. But more subtly even, how about what you're interested in, what compels you? Like, where does that come from? Exactly. Because you can't conjure it up of your own accord, you know? So if you're a student and you're taking a difficult course, you might say to yourself, well, I need to sit down and study for 3 hours. But then you sit down and that isn't what happens. Your attention goes everywhere. And you might say, well, whose attention is it then if it goes everywhere? Because you say it's your attention. It's like, well, if it's your attention, maybe you would be able to control it, but you can't. And so then you might think, well, Jen, just exactly what the hell is controlling it? And you might say, well, it's random. Well, it better not be random. I can tell you that. That happens to some degree in schizophrenia. There's an element of randomness in that. It's not random. It's driven by the action of phenomena that I think are best considered as something like subpersonalities, although even that's only a partial description. You can't make yourself interested in something. Interest manifests itself and grips you. That's a whole different thing. And so what is it that's gripping you? And how do you conceptualize that? Is that a divine power? Well, it's divine as far as you're concerned because it grips you and you can't do anything about it. And so there's a calling in you towards what you're compelled by and what you're interested in. And sometimes that might be very dark and sometimes not. But you're compelled forward by your interest. And so the idea that what moves you away from your country and your father's house and the comforts of your childhood home is something that's beyond you and that you listen to and hearken to. That's exactly right. And you can say, well, I don't want to call that God. It's like, it doesn't matter what you call it exactly. It doesn't matter to what it is, what it's called. It still is. And if you don't listen to it, that's the other thing. If you don't listen to it, and I've been a clinician and talked to enough people now, as old as I am, to know this absolutely. If you do not listen to that thing that beckons you forward, you will pay for it like you cannot possibly imagine. You'll have everything that's terrible about life in your life and nothing about it that's good. And worse, you'll know that it was your fault and that you squandered what you could have had. Heidegger thought that Western philosophy had gone wrong basically since the time of Socrates, which is, you know, quite a long time. And he said that we became interested in what the world was made of and how we knew things, and what we should have been interested in instead was the nature and quality of being. And what he meant by being isn't the objective world. What he meant by being was the manner in which you have experience. And so there are elements of being that aren't objective elements. And so I would say pain is a phenomenological reality, right? It's not something, you can index it objectively, but the index is not the phenomena. And, you know, is your pain real? See, this is a question for people who think there's no such thing as meaning. Like, you try to argue yourself out of pain and see how far you get. You might think, well, that's not the sort of meaning I meant. It's like, you know, a negative meaning is a place to start, right? Because if something's negative and it's real, it does imply that there's something positive that's real. It might be harder to get a hold of. At least it's not pain, you know? So, but pain, Descartes, and I'll close with this, you guys can have a break. Descartes implemented a method he called radical doubt when he went on his philosophical journey. And what Descartes looked for was one thing he couldn't doubt, because he was probably clinically depressed, and he was just doubting everything. It's like, well, how do I know the world isn't just a mirage made by an evil demon to obfuscate reality from me? Well, his conclusion was the one thing that he could not dispute was that he was and could think. Now, I don't think Descartes really meant what we meant by think. I think he meant more what we would mean by experience. Because thought has become a much more narrowly defined term since the time of Descartes. So So I don't think he meant, I think, therefore I am. I think he meant something like, I experience, I have experience, therefore I am. But regardless of that, modern people think about it as thought. Heidegger was different. Heidegger basically said, the one thing you can't dispute is that experience is your experience. It exists. You can't, it's almost by definition, right? It's like the definition of exist. And then he was interested in what the fundamental elements of existence were. And they're not atoms, like the fundamental elements of the objective world. They're more things like pain. And for me, that was the thing that stopped me from doubting. It's like, I cannot doubt the existence of pain. It seems real. And I might say, it seems more real than anything else. Now, you might say you don't believe that, but I would say, I don't care what you think you believe. I'll watch you when you're in pain. And every single one of your actions will indicate that you believe in it. And not only that, that you can't not believe in it. Right? It's there, and it's there so much that, well, that's a meaning. And so that it's in that way that Heidegger, at least in part, thought of existence as, or experience as, composed of meanings. And so part of the reason that this course is called Maps of Meaning is because one of the things we're going to look at is the structure of meaning. And we're going to start with negative meaning because, from my perspective, you can doubt whether or not good exists. But once I'm done telling you about the things I know about human history, there won't be a single person in this room who thinks that evil doesn't exist. And you might think that's a bloody horrible thing to learn, but it's not. It's unbelievably useful because once you can establish something that you cannot deny, then you can move from that. And I think you can hypothesize that if you're capable of detecting radical evil, I'll tell you about Unit 731 at some point, or you can look them up yourself. I wouldn't recommend it, by the way. Once you can identify radical evil, and you think, well, that's just beyond a doubt, that's reprehensible. There's no justification for that whatsoever, no matter what, whenever. Well, then you've got something to stand on. And you can start thinking, well, what's the absolute opposite of that then? You know, it might be, how is it that you could conduct yourself so that in your sphere of influence, the probability like that anything like that would ever happen is reduced to the absolute maximum? Well, that's a reasonable moral question. And I don't think it's something that you can dispense with like a casual nihilism. I don't think a nihilist can dispense with it. Because even nihilists suffer. Thank God for that. You know, it's their only source of potential salvation. Sometimes they notice it. Oh, I'm suffering about all this nihilism. Maybe that indicates that there's something flawed in it. It's always possible.
You know, I've really seen this in people. It's a hell of a thing not to have the confidence of your father. It's really, really hard on people. You know, if your father is someone who says to you, you can do it. I really believe that you can do it. I'll support you in what you're doing. I think that you can sort it out. And then acts towards you in that way. That's a gift that really almost no one else can provide you with. Mothers obviously provide, I think they provide the same kind of gift, but earlier. You know, because the mother has to take care of the infant when the infant is just completely dependent. And so, and this is Erikson's idea too, Erik Erikson, is the mother is the person who establishes the relationship that allows the developing person to manifest trust, real trust. While you're being carried, for crying out loud, you know, you can be dropped. And the mother's also the source of food. But the father seems to be something like the, I'm obviously parsing these things farther apart than they can be, need to be, because the father can play a nurturing role and the mother can play an encouraging role, but we'll keep it simple for now. The father seems to be the thing that supports and encourages and says, well, yeah, you know, you're little and small and all of that, and you're subject to destruction and bullying and social pressure and all that, but I know you can do it. I know you can do it. And there's a force in that that's unbelievable, and people who don't have that have a hell of a time. It's actually one of the things that's quite fun about doing psychotherapy, because you get people who have damaged father figures. It's harder with a damaged mother figure, eh? Because it's so bloody deep. You know, I had a client who I just thought she was a remarkable person, but her relationship with her mother was really disrupted, and it was really, really hard to... She told me it was like something had been torn out of her at an early age that couldn't be replaced. It's really... Because you just can't be someone's mother, you know? It's really hard. You're just not there enough for that. But you can sort of be someone's surrogate father. That's a That's a role you can play later. And that's what educators do, at least to some degree, although now they're trying to be mothers and providing safe spaces and all of that, which is not really all that appropriate. So the father is an encouraging figure and allows the individual, at least in principle, to support the catastrophe of being voluntarily. And so, anyway, so those, you know, those images, they're just brilliant beyond belief, absolutely brilliant beyond belief. And the thing about a comprehensive narrative is it can't leave out an archetypal character, or it fails. Now, I can give you an example of this, okay? So, how many of you have seen Disney's Sleeping Beauty? Okay, so many of you have. How many haven't? Okay, so there's a few that haven't. Well, the Disney movies, you know, they're kind of standard childhood fare. Now, in Sleeping Beauty, what happens is that the king and queen give birth to a princess after trying for a substantial amount of time. And, you know, she arrives healthy and beautiful, and then they have a christening day, and they invite everybody to it, but they don't invite Maleficent, who's a dark witch, roughly speaking. You know, like she's queen of the underworld, that for lack of a better word. She's the negative element of femininity. And they don't invite her to the party. And so she shows up anyways and says that because they didn't invite her, their daughter's going to die when she hits 16, which is, you know, roughly the age of, let's say, sexual maturation for a story of that sort. Now, there's another little positive magic female in the story who mitigates that death sentence to protracted sleep. Well, the idea behind it's a very, very interesting story. It's an Oedipal story in a sense, because what it says is that if your parents protect you too much from the dark side of life when you're young, that what will happen when you start to on the road to maturity is you'll be so naive and so fragile that you'll want to be unconscious instead of paying attention, and that you're going to have to be rescued from that state by something. And it could be a prince, which is how that story lays itself out, or it also could be the symbolically masculine and exploratory element of your own psyche. And the stories are ambivalent about whether it's an external event or an internal event. It doesn't really matter. You know, the things end up being the same. And so that's actually what happens in this Sleeping Beauty story. You know, at the end, a prince who's also enslaved by this terrible negative feminine force manages to escape, and the Maleficent turns into a dragon, and he has to fight her, and then he goes and rescues the princess, and she wakes up, and the kingdom's rejuvenated, and everybody's happy. It's a classic, classic story. You know, and it's not... It's funny, because the Disney movie Frozen...
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Put forward as a, in some sense, as a feminist alternative to the classic fairy tales. And first of all, you can't do that. You can't just generate up a fairy tale. You know, there's recent evidence that some of these fairy tales, the ones that the Grimm brothers and Hans Christian Andersen collected, are up to 10,000 years old. You can't just come up with a counter fairy tale. That's just not how it works. And the way that fairy tale is structured, it has nothing to do with the necessity for anyone to rely on anyone else for anything. It's a complex portrayal of the dynamic relationship between archetypal characters. And, you know, it's one form of the story. There's lots of different forms of the story. But what I like about Sleeping Beauty, for example, and this is what's nice about the real fairy tales, is that along with the positive, there's negative, and it's real negative. Like, real fairy tales are terrifying. Like, who is it? Is it in Sleeping Beauty? Or in Snow White? I don't remember. In one of the famous Grimm fairy tales, one of the evil sisters ends up dancing in red hot shoes till she dies. You know, they're very, very violent and unsettling. And it's because they have the quality of genuine folk tales. But the reason for that is because they're dealing with real things. Like the Hansel and Gretel story is a good example of that, right?
kids are abandoned out in the woods. They find something that's too good to be true. Inside this thing that's too good to be true is something that wants to fatten them up and devour them. It's a rough story. But what it's doing, the stories have evolved to represent the fundamental dynamic elements of existence. If you conceptualize existence in terms of character. And the thing is, you have to conceptualize existence in terms of character if you're a person, because what you do in existence is act out your character. So your character is an element of existence. Now, you might say, well, that doesn't mean that society has a character. But actually, it does mean that. And because partly what happens, like if you're socialized, say, into a culture, the culture exists in the same relationship to you, roughly speaking, as another person does. So, for example, if you put money in the bank, which is in principle a representation of your labor, what you're doing is entering into a contract with the broader social world, which is one of promise, essentially, where the future society promises to return your value at a future date. So it's a contractual relationship. And the reason that God the Father is a very common representation is because treating the they in Heideggerian terms, the others in Heideggerian terms, as if they're an embodied entity actually works. And you might say, well, what's your evidence that those differences in personality aren't culturally constructed? And the evidence for that is quite clear. You can go online, you can look up the Scandinavian studies. Just go online and look up gender differences in personality cross-culturally. You'll find the relevant studies. They've been done with tens of thousands of people, and what they've showed quite clearly is that in those societies where the most has been done to move the social world into a position of radical equality, and so that would roughly be the Scandinavian countries, because they've done more of that than any other country, the personality differences between men and women maximize. They don't minimize. They maximize. And I'll say that again. In the countries where the most has been done to equalize the playing field between men and women get more different rather than more the same. So for all you social constructionists out there in the audience, and there's probably not that many of you because you wouldn't come and hear me talk if you were a social constructionist, you're actually wrong. Yeah. Well, the thing is, you know, that so one of the things you might be interested in is that it's all the same to me in some sense. Like when I was looking into this to begin with, and this would have started probably 25 years ago, looking at differences in personality between men and women, you know, it wasn't obvious at all whether they were fundamentally biological or fundamentally sociological or what mix produced the differences. You know, no one knew. And the most logical hypothesis, really, I thought, was that as you equalize the society, that men and women would become more the same. But that is not what happened. And so we've actually put the social constructionist hypothesis with regards to gender differences in sex and personality, we put that to the test in a very intense way, and the social constructionist viewpoint failed. So it's very strange, because no one would have really believed that, right? You make society more the same, and men and women get more different. It's like, what's up with that? Well, the answer seems to be is that there's fundamentally two sources of variability in personality, right? There's perhaps more, but you can categorize them as roughly genetic and roughly sociological. Well, if you take out all the sociological differences between the landscape in which men and women are raised, all you have left are the biological and genetic differences. So they maximize. Well, that's exactly what happened. This actually matters. It really matters. And this is why the demands for equity are so, well, there's about 15 reasons why demands for equity border on this is between men and women should not be overlooked, partly because it's wrong to overlook the genuine differences between men and women. It's not good for the men, it's not good for the women. So one of the things you see in Scandinavia, for example, is there's an overwhelming preponderance of female nurses, and there's an overwhelming preponderance of male engineers. And actually, the data on personality differences, there's the standard traits, which I'll continue to go through. I can do that quite quickly. There's not much difference in trait conscientiousness between men and women. If you break it down into the aspects, women are a bit more orderly than men, but there's no difference in industriousness. And then with regards to openness, which is the intellect creativity dimension, overall there's no difference between men and women, but if you break it up into the aspects, then the differences are actually quite pronounced. So what you have is the openness to experience is the technical trait, and it roughly breaks down into something that's sort of like creativity and aesthetic interests versus interest in ideas. And what you see is that women are a third of the standard deviation higher than men in terms of creativity and aesthetic proclivity, let's say, and men are one third of a standard deviation higher than women in terms of interest in ideas. And it's not a trivial difference, and it makes a difference. So, but the biggest difference between men and women, as it turns out, and this is almost one standard deviation, which is a walloping difference. You never see that in social science. It's a massive difference. Difference in interest. And the masculine interest, roughly speaking, is in things, and the female interest, roughly speaking, is in people. And that's what underlies the differences, say, in career choice preference between things like nursing and psychology and social work and that sort of thing, and engineering. And because engineering is perhaps the most male-oriented of all the disciplines, and the evidence that's sociological is very, very weak.
One of the things that I learned while I was going through this was the meaning of the name Israel, because Jacob eventually gets named Israel. And I'm jumping ahead a little bit to the next lecture, but Israel, and so he's also the father of Israel and the father of the 12 sons who make up the 12 tribes of Israel. But what Israel means is he who struggles with God. And that's such an interesting idea, because it's, again, a psychological idea. And that's why I said earlier that it isn't obvious in the Old Testament what it means to believe in God, because what Jacob does is struggle with God. And I think that that's a really good characterization of an ethical life, because if you're trying to lead an ethical life, that's what you're doing, is you're struggling. Like, blind belief isn't helpful, because you don't know what you're believing in. Like, it's just not that helpful. But if you're possessed by the desire to orient yourself properly, but also confused by the existential structure of the world, which we all are, then what you're doing when you're trying to orient yourself properly in life is struggling ethically. And Jacob actually gets quite hurt. He wrestles with God, literally, and God dislocates his thigh. And so, you know, the idea there is, watch the hell out, right? The thing that you're contending with is powerful, although you can contend with it. That's the thing that's so interesting. But, you know, you do it at some genuine peril, which I think is exactly right. But the idea that Israel, so there's Israel, the state, let's say, and Israel, the promised land, and all of that. But there's this more important idea, which is, again, a psychological idea, which is the state of Israel, which is the promised land, is the state that everyone who wrestles with God exists in. And that's not happy, naive belief in, you know, an eternally blessed afterlife. It's not that. It's not a wish fulfillment. It's to be actively engaged in life, in the difficulties of life, right? And trying to find the path, because that's what wrestling with God is. It's trying to find the path. And that seems to me what belief means fundamentally in the Old Testament, and perhaps in the New Testament as well, is that belief is expressed in trying to find the path. And that's an ethical struggle, and it's a real struggle. It's the struggle of life. So as long as you're willing to engage in that struggle, then, hypothetically, you have the divine behind you. And so, I believe that. I think that's true. Because the other thing I see is that the people who set things right so that the horrible forces of cosmic destruction don't do us in, the people who are trying to set things right are the ones that are struggling ethically. And so, and that there is a redemptive element to that. And I don't think there's any way of being cynical about that. So,
Joanna says, some researchers see shame as something that is very destructive. The consensus seems to be that it is an emotion that is always destructive. Do you agree with this? No, that's absolutely ridiculous. And only modern psychologists and probably social psychologists would be foolish enough to even dare to posit such something so absolutely absurd. Psychopathy and shamelessness are the same thing. So shame isn't shame. No emotion is always destructive. Any emotion taken to an extreme can be destructive, just like any value taken to an extreme, you know, made into one thing can be destructive. So joy can be destructive. I mean, people who are manic are in some sense possessed by a radical excess of positive emotion, and they get incredibly impulsive. And it's terribly destructive. I mean, there's almost no form of insanity that's more destructive than mania. People will go out and spend all their money, all their family's money, and, well, it engage in all sorts of hyper-optimistic interactions with the world. It will result in their complete ruin. So, you know, people think of happiness as an untrammeled positive. Well, if you think of happiness as positive emotion, which is partly true because it's also the absence of negative emotion, if you think of happiness as only a good, then you have no idea about the pathologies of positive emotion, and they're manifold. And shame is like, if you do something stupid and destructive to yourself or to yourself and the broader social community, you should feel shame and you should pay attention to it and you should learn from it. And if you're not capable of doing that, then people should stay the hell away from you because you're shameless. And of course, for most of Western history, and I don't know enough about other forms of history to also make the same comment, to call someone shameless was a tremendous insult. It meant that they didn't have enough sense to be appalled by their own pathology. And that's just not a good thing at all.
If you're the purchasing manager at a manufacturing plant, you know having a trusted partner makes all the difference. That's why, hands down, you count on Grainger for auto reordering. With on-time restocks, your team will have the cut-resistant gloves they need at the start of their shift. And you can end your day knowing they've got safety well in hand. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.